From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on October 28th, 2012, when a massive hurricane took a left turn. That hurricane had been on a northward path over the Atlantic Ocean, but now it turned left toward the New Jersey coast, in the direction of Manhattan generally. Well, just about 24 hours later, the storm called Sandy made landfall near Atlantic City. It was a storm track that had never been seen in 160 years of Atlantic hurricane observation. By now you know that the damage was widespread, devastating, tens of billions of dollars. At sea, Sandy had been the largest hurricane ever observed since good measurements of hurricanes have existed. And Sandy sparked a number of important questions. Did climate change cause this storm, at least in part? Is climate change likely to cause more or similar storms? And are we prepared to deal with them, whether climate change is related or not? My guest for this hour is an atmospheric scientist at Columbia University who studies weather and the climate. His new book is called Storm Surge: Hurricane Sandy, Our Changing Climate and Extreme Weather of the Past and Future. Adam Sobel, thanks for taking the time and welcome to Connections.
Thank you for having me.
Well, your book is remarkably accessible, I've got to say, certainly an important read, whether we're involved in a scientific career or not. For those of our audience who were hoping that you were going to come on this program and declare that climate change is the culprit of Sandy and others, they might be disappointed, but my take on your book is that climate change might not cause these storms, but it's making us much more vulnerable to them. Is that fair?
Yes, I think that's fair. I mean, climate change and storms poses a communication challenge for us, because when an individual storm happens and the media asks us, did climate change cause the storm, it's hard for us to give, in many cases, a really strong, positive answer. And that's because there's so much natural variability in storms anyway, and any climate change influence is very gradual over a long period of time. And in some cases, we don't even know yet exactly what climate change is going to do. In the case of hurricanes, there are some changes that we expect climate change is starting to make now and eventually will make to a greater extent in the future. We expect stronger hurricanes. There may actually be fewer, but the chance of a strong one may still increase. And in different regions, those changes may be different. But there's so much natural variability that when a particular storm comes along, we can't say climate change caused it in most cases in a very direct way. In the case of Sandy, though, I think because it was a coastal flooding event, and because the sea level here is about a foot higher than it was about 100 years ago, and because a good fraction of that foot is due to climate change, although not all of it, there is a serious role for climate change in increasing our risk of coastal flooding, because as the water starts from a higher baseline, we're more likely to see a given storm surge will add on to a higher sea level. And so we'll have more coastal flooding events, even if the storms don't change. Now, the storms probably are changing, but we don't really need to understand that perfectly in order to see the climate change influence.
For our listeners who want to call the program with questions or comments on this issue, again, we've got Adam Sobel on the program here. His new book is called Storm Surge. He is an atmospheric scientist at Columbia University, and the number to call is 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255. You know, Adam, Governor Andrew Cuomo is one of many people who've been claiming for some time now that climate change is behind the increase in storms. Before we get to some of his specific comments, I want to address a point that you write about in the book, and you write, quote, "We can't yet detect a clear long-term upward trend in hurricane activity, either in the Atlantic or generally." And I know that surprises some people, but to clarify, we're not seeing more hurricanes in recent years, is that correct?
Well, so it depends what measure you look at. There has been an increase in hurricane activity in the Atlantic from the 70s to about the mid-2000s, culminating in the extreme season of 2005, which had Katrina and all that. Since then, the last few years have been a little bit quieter. That upward trend, though, is not clearly due to climate change. Some of it could be, but the underlying problem, again, it's not that climate change isn't changing things. It's that hurricanes vary so much from year to year and even decade to decade that to detect a slow increase due to climate change on top of that is very difficult, even if it's there. In other words, another way to put it is, if the climate change were causing an increase in hurricane activity that were great enough that we could already see it on top of the large natural variability, we'd be in really serious trouble because it would mean that there was a huge increase in hurricane activity. So the fact that we can't see it doesn't mean it's not there. It just means that when we ask questions about how climate change is influencing hurricanes, we have to ask not just what we can already see in the observations, but what we understand because of the physics of the storms and how they relate to the climate and what we expect to happen in the future over the longer time period. And again, I think also we have to take into account that a lot of the damage is due to storm surge, and that's influenced by sea level rise, which we understand much more clearly and which we can see in the observations very clearly.
One of our listeners named Jake writes to us and says, wants to know what your guest says about this. I've always understood climate change with a very simple analogy. The Earth's climate is like a boiling pot of water. When you turn the heat up, you get more bubbles, weather, and larger bubbles, more extremes, both large and small. We know we're heating up the water, but we can never show which bubbles we made. How does that analogy work for you, Adam?
It's not bad. There's some truth to it. There's a lot of natural variability in random weather events, and you can never pin any one exactly on climate change. But what you can say in some cases is that the change in climate changes the probability of an event occurring. So you can do a kind of what we call probabilistic attribution. In other words, it's more likely. And then there are some cases where we can do that now, only very recently, more clearly than in the past with some types of extreme events. So, for example, the recent Australian heat wave the last year or so was extreme enough, was very extreme, and the research on that shows quite clearly that the probability of that happening has increased greatly due to human-induced climate change. And so that particular event, a fairly conclusive partial attribution could be made. And I think heat waves are the cases where we can see it the most clearly because heat waves are the events that are related to global warming in the simplest way. I mean, as the temperature gets warmer, the chance of a high temperature event increases almost in as simple a way as you would think it would. Hurricanes are more complicated and more difficult to do that kind of assignment. So it's not necessarily impossible to say that climate change plays a role in a specific weather event, but in most events of the kind we're interested in, like hurricanes, we're not quite yet able to do that with great confidence. And it'll always be difficult because of the large degree of natural variability. But we can still ask reasonable questions and maybe answer them about what long-term trends we expect in the probabilities of such events.
Adam, here's a statement on the website of the National Wildlife Federation. Quote, global warming is making hot days hotter, rainfall and flooding heavier, hurricanes stronger, and droughts more severe. This intensification of weather and climate extremes will be the most visible impact of global warming in our everyday lives. Is that oversimplifying? What do you make of that statement?
Whenever we try to boil things down to a few sentences, there's always some simplification, but I think by and large, those statements are true enough as long as we understand them to be true in the aggregate. In other words, when we talk about large sets of events, we can make stronger statements than we can about individual events. And that's just the way statistics works. I mean, you talk about the probability of something, then you can say there's going to be more of such events, or on average, they're going to be more intense than average. So, I don't think that statement is particularly bad. And I should say, with respect to hurricanes, there are indications already, although I write in the book that we can't see an upward trend in activity, there are a number of studies showing that the most intense storms, the Category 4s and 5s in the Saffir-Simpson scale that ranks hurricane intensity, do seem to be occurring more frequently over the last decades compared to previous ones. Now, that's still something that scientists are debating, but there is evidence of that.
Yeah, you said earlier in this conversation that we might even see fewer hurricanes, but climate change could make them stronger. And I have to say that as a reader of your book, Storm Surge, and as someone who is trying to understand climate as a non-scientist, I greatly appreciate the fact that there isn't a shred, there's not even a single sentence in your book that felt like it was alarmist, not perfectly grounded in science. And I appreciate that. But when you, so now let me ask you, when it comes to the fact that there could possibly be fewer storms but stronger storms, what could the connection to climate be to stronger storms?
Right. First of all, thank you for the kind words about the book. I think when talking about climate change, the realities are alarming enough, and so one doesn't really need to exaggerate
sure.
in order to make the problem serious. As far as stronger storms, hurricane intensity is something that we understand relatively well compared to some other aspects of hurricanes. There's a fairly mature theory that explains what's the maximum intensity a given hurricane can achieve. It's called potential intensity theory, and a lot of it is due to Kerry Emanuel at MIT. And it explains for a given environment what's the maximum intensity you can achieve, and it does that using concepts of thermodynamics that are fairly well grounded in classical physics. And that's the maximum intensity we have a theory for, and the actual intensity is always less than that, but it seems to be on average proportional to it, so that if the maximum intensity goes up, then the real intensities go up by a comparable percentage. And as the ocean temperature warms and the atmospheric temperature warms, it seems pretty conclusive that maximum intensity will increase. The strength of the storm really depends on the temperature difference between the ocean and the atmosphere. And so it's not quite as simple. We used to think that because hurricanes form over warm water, that if we have more warm water, we'll have more hurricanes and stronger hurricanes. And it's not quite that simple because the atmosphere warms along with the water, and it's really the difference between the two, defined appropriate in an appropriate way, that matters. But that difference does seem to increase in every plausible model of climate change. And so that's the connection. I don't know if that... I haven't gone into all the details, but that's basically how it works.
Okay. And here we are with a lot of people talking about climate change. And I know that you, as a researcher and a scientist, I know you welcome that. I mean, I read your piece on Solana about the polar vortex. We've already had some questions online about the polar vortex. We'll get to that.
Yeah.
I know you welcome the interest in climate, but I want to read a couple of comments from our governor, Andrew Cuomo, which do seem to be evolving. But let me start with this. Andrew Cuomo talking about Hurricane Sandy in 2012. Quote, extreme weather situations is tied to this. I think part of learning from this is the recognition that climate change is reality. Extreme weather is a reality. It is a reality that we are vulnerable, and if we're going to do our job as elected officials, we're going to need to think about how to redesign, or as we go forward, make the modifications necessary so we don't incur this type of damage. The governor said this earlier this year about tornadoes. Quote, we don't get tornadoes in New York. Anyone will tell you that. Well, we do now, and this new normal of extreme weather is a challenge for government. And here he is now, just a few days ago, talking about all the snow in Buffalo. Quote, I don't want to get into a political debate at this time about climate change causes, etc. Forget the causes of this weather. Is it global warming? Is it reliance on fossil fuels? Forget the causes. What is inarguable is the result. So I don't know if someone got to him and said, tone it down a little on blaming every single weather event on climate change. But does it drive you a little nuts to see someone in a position of power like he is seemingly constantly blaming climate change for every weather event when we don't know that that's the case?
It doesn't really bother me that much, to be honest, because I think the bottom line he's getting for, the bottom line he's taking is fine. I mean, in the sense that the extreme weather events are happening, and as governor of the state, he's got to figure out how to deal with them. They have impacts, and you know, obviously he can't avoid them. You've got to just make a lot of decisions about how to help people cope with them when they happen. And it's also true that climate change is increasing the risk of many types of extreme events over time, and a wise government will think ahead about how to plan in the long term to be more resilient against those events. So he may be sometimes incorrect in making an attribution of a given event to climate change, or he may make statements that are a little stronger than the science justifies. And in the case of the tornadoes, I think that's particularly true. I mean, we have had tornadoes here in the past. There was a quiet period for a few years, and then a few years ago we had a burst of them, and so it, you know, it seemed as though there were an increase. But he, over the long term, he's not right about that one. But overall, I think that our tendency in the United States has been not to take climate change seriously enough. And so when I see elected officials trying to start taking it seriously and listen to the science, even if they get the details a little wrong sometimes, I'm not too bothered by it.
Yeah, the analogy you've made is, you know, people regularly talk about sports. They regularly talk about a lot of things. There are blogs about sports. There are talk shows and reporters assigned to cover those beats, politics, music, art appreciation. Why not have more emphasis in those arenas on climate? And if people occasionally get it wrong, well, that's where the Adam Sobels of the world come in and help us with it. So I thought that was an interesting analogy. We're going to get to the phones in just a moment. If you want to join the conversation with Adam Sobel, it's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. He's an atmospheric scientist at Columbia University and the author of a new book called Storm Surge, Hurricane Sandy, Our Changing Climate and Extreme Weather of the Past and Future. The book is out now, and it is absolutely accessible, whether you're a scientist or not. So if you're someone who's interested in climate and the way our world works, absolutely a great read. Let me grab the first caller of the hour. This is Andrew in Irondequoit. Go ahead, Andrew.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. So, Adam, in the early 80s, the USSR went bankrupt because Ronald Reagan's Cold War military race or whatever. And a lot of the weather stations, this is my understanding, went dark, the ones out in Siberia and way out in the middle of nowhere in Russia. And my understanding is that that skewed, not in a good, that skewed the scientists' understanding of global temperatures at that time. Has there been any, do you know anything about that? And has there been any correction of that? Do you know? Have you looked into that kind of thing?
Right. So I can talk broadly to the issue. I wouldn't be surprised if some stations went dark and after the demise of the Soviet Union. I don't know the details of that. It is true that the global observing system is always changing. There's stations closed, new stations open, new instruments become available from satellites that weren't there before. And so the challenge of constructing a global temperature record that is consistent over time is a scientific challenge, but it's one that's worked on by many groups. And I think that the global mean temperature that is the basic index we use of climate change is pretty well constrained over the 20th and early 21st century, despite that. And the uncertainties that there are due to changing observing systems are very carefully studied by large groups of scientists. Okay. So there, I don't mean to say that there's no issue there. It certainly is an important, the changes in the observing system are a serious scientific issue, but I think the magnitude of the climate signals of the last 100 years are large enough on a global scale, and the observations are dense enough that it's not a fundamental problem for our understanding of the global climate system. Although when you look at regional climate changes on smaller areas, these kind of issues can become more serious.
Okay, so are you able to accurately measure now as you weren't before?
Can you be more specific? I mean, accurately measure.
Well, there was a book called Hard Green years ago, and the guy said it's too big and hard to measure it.
What's it?
Well,
the
temperatures and it's a whole planet that you're trying to do a forecast on.
I think the fact that it's a whole planet actually helps because it means that you have more statistics. I mean, the global mean temperature, the global mean surface temperature of the planet, which is the most basic index we use to measure climate change, is pretty well constrained by many measurements in many places, especially in the last, in the post-satellite era since the about the 60s. But even going back before that, it's better over land than ocean, and there's I don't mean to belittle the issues, but I think that when we talk about human-induced global warming and what the scientific uncertainties are, the observational uncertainty in what the global mean surface temperature is not one of the biggest ones. I think we know that quite well enough to address the basic, the most important scientific questions.
And in your book, you, in a number of places, and I'm not remembering all of them offhand, but you refer to the way our understanding of how to measure hurricanes, the size of hurricanes, the strength, their track, apart from other climatological issues, has improved over the years. And you also wrote something that, you know, again, for me, someone outside the field of science, was interesting. Can you talk a little bit about understanding the importance of water vapor's role in climate?
Right. So water vapor is the most important greenhouse gas by total effect on the climate. In other words, the greenhouse gases are what keeps our planet inhabitable, makes it warm enough to live on by trapping infrared radiation as it tries to escape from the Earth to space. It keeps it warmer. It's broadly analogous to the glass in a greenhouse that keeps the warm air from escaping. The greenhouse gases keep the radiation from escaping that keeps the planet warm. And water vapor does the largest part of the job. So then it's people sometimes get confused. Why do we talk about carbon dioxide so much if water vapor does most of the job? And the reason is that water vapor has a very short lifetime in the atmosphere, and carbon dioxide has a long lifetime in the atmosphere. And a warmer atmosphere can have more water vapor in it. So what happens is, if you add some carbon dioxide, you make the planet a little warmer, but then you have more water vapor, and that makes it a little warmer still. And the water vapor can adjust very quickly to whatever the carbon dioxide is doing, but the carbon dioxide can't change. So when we add carbon dioxide, that stays in the climate system a very long time and warms it up, and the water vapor just equilibrates at whatever its natural level is, and that's such that it warms the planet more. And that's also something that I think we've come to understand much better in the last couple of decades. It used to be something climate scientists argued about quite strongly, whether the strength of the water vapor feedback, which is what it, the word we use for it, was as strong as we think it is. And I think now, in the last couple of decades, the research has shown pretty clearly that you just can't make a reasonable climate model in which water vapor doesn't amplify the effects of carbon dioxide. And that's one of the main factors that controls how much warming we are getting as a result of the human-induced greenhouse gases that we're emitting.
The worst kind of feedback loop, in other words.
Well, I don't know if it's the worst, but it's one of the most important ones in our climate. Yes.
Yeah. Guest is Adam Sobel, the author of the new book, Storm Surge, and we've had a number of questions online already. I'm gonna pick a couple here that I think are related. Mark just wants to know more about the polar vortex and whether it's related to climate. And here's another comment. Could your guest comment on the extended jet stream dips we had last year and the one earlier this spring? Is climate change affecting jet stream stability, or is something else going on with those particular events? Your piece for Salon, you gently reminded us that raw cold weather isn't always the polar vortex, that the polar vortex is a thing. And it's not always just cold weather, but why don't we tackle those questions in a step by step. First of all, quick explanation on what the polar vortex is.
Right. So the polar vortex is a word that's used for two somewhat different, although closely related, phenomena. A vortex, of course, is just a spinning bunch of air, and on the global scale, though, the polar vortex is a jet of air high above the atmosphere that circles roughly around the pole. But there's one in the troposphere, which is the lowest layer of the atmosphere where we live, and there's another one in the stratosphere higher up where the ozone layer is. And those two are often disconnected. And that's what I think bothered many meteorologists when the word polar vortex started getting used in the media last winter. At least it's what bothered me, because a lot of the scientific literature that was being quoted is about the stratosphere, and a lot of what the weather phenomenon people were talking about was the troposphere, and it's two different polar vortices. But roughly speaking, you have a jet stream blowing around, encircling the pole with colder air inside it and warmer air outside it. So, that's not an accident. I mean, the jet stream is tightly controlled by those temperature differences, so they always go together. The temperature gradient, as we say, the temperature change with position, is always the wind is always blowing between the cold and the warm air. that's the polar vortex. And so as that jet stream wobbles around, if you're on the side of it that's closer to the pole, you're usually in cold air. And if you're in the side of it that's closer to the equator, you're usually in warm air. So here in New York, we're often on the equator side of it. And further north, you know, high up in Canada, they're often on the polar side of it, and they're in colder air. But when that jet stream dips down, then when it dips to our south, then we get colder air and often snow and all those other things. So they are related. And the question is whether those events, like we had last winter and earlier this fall, where the jet stream stays in an unusually southward displaced position, whether those are related to climate change. And I think my take on it is the answer is probably no, although we don't understand everything there. There has been some research suggesting that big wiggles in the jet stream or big displacements of the edge of the polar vortex, which could put us on the wrong side when we wouldn't normally be, that those are more likely to happen in a warming climate because of what we call polar amplification, which means that the pole warms more than the equator. And that is a real feature of climate change, that the poles warm the most. And you would think that that would make these kind of events like cold snaps less likely because the cold air is getting especially less cold. And I think that's still probably more or less true. But the argument is that that weakens the jet stream and that makes it wobble around more, and therefore somewhat counterintuitively, we could get more of these events. Now, I am not convinced by this research, and I think many of us in the field are not convinced by it. It's one example of something that we're still arguing about. And it's certainly the case that these events can happen naturally, and there's a tremendous amount of variability in the winter, in winter weather naturally. And so when one of these events happens, our first assumption should be that it's natural. But we're definitely still trying to understand what makes those large displacements occur and what makes them last so long. I should say that one clear feature that our best climate models do indicate about a warming climate is that the jet stream overall should move north, further towards the pole, which would put us more often on the equatorward side of it, on the southern side of it, and reduce those cold snaps. But that doesn't tell us about this wobbling issue, which is somewhat unrelated. And so there's still some debate there, but by and large, I'm not inclined to attribute those kind of events to global warming.
My guest is Adam Sobel, atmospheric scientist at Columbia University and author of the new book, Storm Surge. If you're on the phone waiting to join the conversation, we will get to you in just a moment. I wanted to follow up just on the polar vortex side with another related comment online. And you can tweet to the program at Evan Dawson. Danielle wants to know if climate change is to blame for the extreme recent Buffalo snow. Well, today we saw Governor Cuomo requesting federal aid for the devastating effects of that Buffalo storm, and even for Buffalo, historic in nature. But Adam, when it comes to the question of whether climate change is to blame, what's the answer for Danielle?
Well, again, I think we should start by trying to separate the individual weather event from the overall climate signals. Again, climate change is real. It's happening. And one of the effects of that is that the air holds more water vapor. And so all else equal, in an event where you have snow, if it remains cold enough to snow, and of course warming is going to mean that in some places where it used to be cold enough to snow, it won't be, and you'll have rain instead. But if it remains cold enough to snow, then if you have more water vapor in the air, you can get an increased snowfall. So there is some research that's quite credible indicating that lake effect snows, like we saw in Buffalo, when they happen, may produce more snow in a warming climate. Now, again, there's huge natural variability, so it's one can't make very strong statements, at least based on the current science, about that single event, but those kind of events, with a moderate amount of global warming where it stays cold enough to snow in winter, which it still will in Buffalo for a good fraction of the winter. I mean, that the time of the winter where it's cold enough to snow will get shorter as it gets, you know, the spring comes earlier and the fall, you know, lasts longer in the warmer climate. But in that period where it is cold enough to snow, which will still be a good chunk of the winter, lake effect snows like that may get heavier. That's a reasonable inference to draw from the current science, yes.
All right, 60-second break. We're coming back, going to the phones. Your questions for atmospheric scientist Adam Sobel when we come back right here on member-supported public radio. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let's go to Mike in Livonia. You're on with atmospheric scientist Adam Sobel. Go ahead, Mike.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I had to do a an essay on climate change, and a book that I read was called The Deniers by Lawrence Solomon, and he had a chapter in the book that spoke to the different studies at the time that had done measurements on how much carbon stayed in the air and how long it stayed in the air and how much, you know, was embellished to make it sound like carbon stays up there forever as opposed to, like, say, 9 or 10 or 12 years. I didn't hear, because I just caught on in the middle of the program. How long does the guest speaker say that carbon actually exists in the atmosphere?
Right. So the lifetime of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is very long. It depends a little bit on how you define it, but certainly hundreds, if not thousands of years. 10 years is a very incorrectly low estimate. I'm not sure where that came from, but it stays in a very long time. It cycles through. I mean, some carbon goes into the oceans again and into the land and out again, but the average lifetime is quite long, such that the carbon we're putting now in the atmosphere really commits us to a fair bit more of global warming, even if we were to stop emitting carbon today, which, of course, we can't do because our economy depends on it. So I'm not sure the source of that number, but
that's what I'm saying. Maybe I just don't understand what differences there is in carbon, but I mean, the gist of it was that there was 45 to 50 studies conducted through the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and into the 70s, even the 90s, that showed that the carbon lifespan in the atmosphere was anywhere from 8, 9 to only 20 years, and that the claims by the climate changers are saying that it lasts for hundreds of years, which doesn't really show in the data that they've collected showing how carbon doesn't last that long, and that the ages of the different molecules that they've kept track of. The book is The Deniers by Lawrence Solomon. It's readily available, and there's a chapter on there, and I don't have it in front of me, but it's the one question that I have that really doesn't, you know, make me one side or the other. I'm still questioning, because it just seems like the planet's going to emit carbon, whether we change or not. Things are still going to decompose, and the natural sinks that absorb it are still going to be there, and the natural things that emit it are still going to be there. So it's only a small percentage of the air. How does it matter whether or not we're producing some more instead of a decomposing forest?
Thank you, Mike. Go ahead, Adam.
So you raised a few different issues there, and some of them are really standard, misunderstandings that are promoted by those who don't accept the science of climate change. It's true, first of all, that carbon dioxide, let's focus on carbon dioxide. Carbon, I mean, there's other species of carbon in the atmosphere, but carbon dioxide is the most important one for climate change. It's true that there are many natural sources and sinks of carbon dioxide, and there would be carbon dioxide in the atmosphere even if humans didn't emit it. In fact, that's why the planet is inhabitable. It's the greenhouse gases that keep it warm enough, and carbon dioxide is an important one. So it's true that there's carbon dioxide already there, but we are making a significant difference to it. The pre-industrial value of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere was about 280 parts per million, and we're over 400 now. So that's a significant change. Within the end of the century, it's, you know, almost certain that we'll have doubled or more than doubled the pre-industrial concentration of carbon dioxide. So we understand that. It's quite well measured. The lifetime of, you know, I don't know where those low numbers are coming from, but the lifetime really is quite long, at least hundreds to thousands, if not thousands of years. And so, you know, that's the state of the science on that. The other thing you hear is, well, since carbon dioxide is such a small fraction of the air, how can it do anything? And that's true. It is a small fraction of the air. 400 parts per million is a small fraction of a percent of the atmosphere. But that doesn't matter. Most of the molecules in the air, which are nitrogen and oxygen, don't have any significant effect on infrared radiation. So if they were all that was in the atmosphere, then we wouldn't have any greenhouse effect. But carbon dioxide, although it's a small fraction of the mass of the atmosphere, of the material in the atmosphere, it is very effective at trapping greenhouse gas, at the greenhouse trapping of infrared radiation. So it's able to have a disproportionately large effect on the climate system. And there's really no debate about this. I mean, the irradiative effects of carbon dioxide, the extent to which it absorbs infrared radiation, how effective it is at that, is really extremely well known. It's basic physics. And so, you know, these notions, well, how can it do, and, you know, the overall notion, you also hear things, well, since the climate varies a lot anyway, how can we do anything? Or since there's a lot of carbon in the atmosphere anyway, how can, you know, the little bit that we're doing matter? You hear these kinds of arguments a lot. And that's really a completely fallacious argument. It's like saying, well, people die anyway. Imagine if somebody accused of murder in a murder trial saying, well, people die anyway, so what does it matter that I killed this one guy, right? It's an absurd argument. The fact that something sometimes happens naturally doesn't in any way change the fact that human beings can also have an influence on it.
Well,
so it's really a...
I was going to say, I've never been moved by the notion that carbon would be a small part of the atmosphere, therefore it could make much of a difference. Maybe that's because when I was 15 years old and I was a busboy, the chef at the restaurant I was working at made me eat a cracker with about a fingernail-sized drop of Dave's Insanity hot sauce on it, and I thought, well, what am I worried about? That's the smallest amount of hot sauce I've ever seen, and I spent the next hour in the fetal position. So, you know, sometimes it doesn't take much to make an impact. But for our listeners who are just joining us, we're talking to Adam Sobel, who is the author of a new book called Storm Surge, Hurricane Sandy, Our Changing Climate and Extreme Weather of the Past and Future. He's an atmospheric scientist at Columbia University, and the book is... for anybody who's just wanting to understand more about when we see these large storms, especially like Sandy, what's causing the storm, and then sort of as a parallel, where does climate change come in? Really, really valuable reading stuff. Now, Adam, you referenced what happened in Australia our last winter, their summer. And we can be a little myopic about weather. I mean, last winter in New York State, it was raw all the time. Very, very, very cold, and largely because the polar vortex paid an extended visit, as you said. But at the same time, I had a friend in Australia who said birds are falling, animals are falling dead out of trees. It is so hot and dry, even for our standards. Well, on the west coast of the United States, we've seen an extended drought in California, and today we've got our friends out there dealing with, what, up to 6 inches of rain in one day and 60 to 80 mile an hour winds. And so I guess I'm only painting the picture that says, number one, we can be a little too myopic about what's happening in our small part of the world. But number two, when you look at California, for example, we had Danielle who emailed the program and wanted to know if the buffalo snow was caused by climate change. And the answer is we don't know. It's possible. What about California? Their extended drought and now this extreme weather they're seeing today. Any idea if it, at least is it possible that climate change is related?
So actually, a report just came out sponsored by NOAA and written by one of my colleagues here at Columbia, Richard Seeger, about the California drought and the causes for it. And they, although they're not by any means climate change deniers, and they're fully they're climate scientists who fully endorse the consensus of human-induced climate change. Nonetheless, they came to the conclusion in that study that the California drought, this particular California drought, is predominantly natural in origin and due to natural variability in sea surface temperatures in the Pacific. That doesn't mean that California isn't in trouble due to climate change in the future. We do expect more droughts in the southwestern U.S., southwestern North America overall, as the climate warms, and California will experience some of that, but this one they attribute mostly to natural causes. In terms of the deficit of rainfall, now the fact that the climate is warmer also plays some role in making the drought worse, because it means that whatever water is in the soil is a little more likely to evaporate. So for the same amount of rainfall, you can have an exacerbated hydrological drought, in other words, less soil moisture. But so this particular drought doesn't appear to be strongly attributable to global warming, although that doesn't mean by any means that their concern about a droughtier future is misplaced. This storm that's happening now, again, is the kind of thing where in a warmer atmosphere, you know, this storm is what we call an atmospheric river or a Pineapple Express event, which means that tropical moisture is streaming up in a huge plume that extends back to Hawaii and is ramming into the West Coast and raining out as it hits the coast and the mountains there. And so in a warmer atmosphere, we would have a little more water vapor in that plume and a little bit heavier rain. And so those kinds of events may well become more extreme. A given storm like this, again, you know, its details are going to be mostly due to the natural chaos and variability of the atmosphere. But the best thing that can be said for it is that it's going to put a little bit of a dent in the drought, although I think they need quite a few more still in order to end it.
Back to the phones. This is John in Rochester. John, go ahead.
Hey, Evan. Professor, a couple questions for you. Number one, we were under a glacier here in Rochester 12,000 years ago. I don't know. I've heard it's as high as a mile. And that melted without man-made global warming. The other question I have for you, I'd like you to comment on that, but the other question I have for you, I've heard that the Arctic ice is melting at a significant pace, but there's been reports that I've read that the Antarctic ice is actually building up. So why the differences, if in fact there are differences?
Thank you, John. Go ahead, Adam.
Right. So the about the glacier over North America, that's absolutely right. There was a huge glacier over a lot of northern North America, including Rochester, 12,000 years ago. That melted due to natural causes, and that's because the climate does vary naturally on its own on many timescales, including timescales of thousands to even hundreds of thousands and even millions of years, among other things due to the slight variations in the orbit of the Earth, the really long shifts between ice ages and so-called interglacials or warmer periods are strongly influenced by small changes in the orbit of the Earth over very long timescales. That's fine. I mean, we know that the climate varies naturally. It always will vary naturally. What humans are doing is adding to that, is creating a steady warming now that's on top of whatever the natural variations would be. And I think that's unequivocal. What was the other question? I've already forgotten what it was.
Arctic versus Antarctic sea ice.
Oh, Arctic versus Antarctic, right. Right. So the Arctic sea ice has been melting quite a lot in the last couple of decades. Some of that is certainly, almost certainly a climate change signal. Some of it's also natural variability. The Antarctic, it is true that there have been slight increases in Antarctic sea ice. The ice on land in Antarctic, however, is melting. So I cannot give a detailed explanation of the increase in sea ice in Antarctic. I'm not actually a polar expert, and I haven't followed the latest research on that. I think scientists are working on it very hard, but there's, of course, lots of natural variability in the system. Antarctic, of course, the two poles are very different, right? The North Pole is ocean surrounded by land, and then Antarctica is land surrounded by ocean. So most of the pole, and the southern pole is covered by land with ice on it, and that ice is melting at a disconcerting rate. And that's what matters, by the way, for sea level. So sea level rise is one of the most serious concerns, one of the most serious and most certain problems we're going to experience as a result of climate change. And sea ice doesn't affect sea level because the sea ice, by definition, is already floating in the sea. And so when it melts, it's still in the sea, and the weight it has is the same by Archimedes' principle. The sea doesn't rise when sea ice melts. But when ice on land melts, that's water that used to be on land and now flows into the sea, and that's what happens when big chunks of icebergs on land break off and fall in.
So keep our eyes on the land. Keep our eyes on the land ice.
Well, the sea ice is important for many reasons. I mean, it's not the sea ice isn't important, but it doesn't affect sea level. So for sea level, it's Greenland and Antarctica that are the really big stores of land ice that we should be concerned about.
Mike in Rochester, go ahead, Mike.
Yeah. It's me again, calling back, listening. And to follow up, though, my main issue, though, is that if the natural variability is already there and humans are naturally a variable on the planet, doesn't it make sense that we're just going to change the climate eventually anyways? I don't understand you can't ask people to go backwards in their progression to consume less and to be less than they have become. It's anti-humane, I think. And I don't understand the hubbub over climate change because, yeah, it's occurring. It's always occurred. It's never going to stop. It's always going to change. So doesn't it make more sense just to adapt and find better technology and innovations to deal with maybe a rising ocean or a rising lake or a disappearing lake? Just find better ways to accommodate human activity.
Mike, thanks for the call. I think what Mike is saying there is what do we do about policy? And the difference, there's a big difference, isn't there, Adam, between acknowledging that something is happening and then debating what to do about it.
That's right. I mean, I first of all, though, I think there's two different issues there. I mean, again, saying climate varies naturally doesn't in any way refute the fact that humans are having effect on it. That's like saying if you ask, does cigarettes cause lung cancer, you could say, well, people are going to get cancer anyway. But we know that smoking cigarettes makes you more likely to get lung cancer. So the fact that some cancer is natural doesn't change the fact that some cancer is human-induced. So that's the first point. About going backwards, I mean, yeah, I think the most important thing we have to do to start the discussion about climate change is to accept the science and understand what's happening. Then we can talk about what to do about it, and that's going to be a question of values and also a question of what technology is available and a question of what policies we want to do, and science can only address some of that and not all of it. But I think the idea that addressing, and we will have to adapt. I mean, some warming has already happened, and some more would be locked in because of the carbon we've already emitted, even if we stop emitting carbon today. So when the caller says, don't we just have to adapt to it, the answer is yes, we do have to adapt to it, but that doesn't mean that we can't reduce the damage that we're going to experience. And rising sea level, which is going to take away a bunch of the land that we live on, is certainly something that would be better not to have to experience any more of that than we have to. But I think the notion that reducing fossil fuel emissions has to result in some kind of backward move for humanity is really misplaced. I mean, renewable energy, solar and wind power, has been dropping rapidly in price in the last few years, that's almost certainly going to continue. And so I don't see the harm in making policies that encourage that. There's no reason that burning fossil fuels is better than any other form of energy intrinsically. For example, in the United States over the last few years, our carbon emissions have actually been decreasing already, and that's been happening because we've transferred more of our fossil fuel burning to natural gas. We're burning more natural gas relative to coal and oil. Is that bad? I mean, is there something wrong with the fact that we've been burning natural gas instead of coal and oil? It wasn't done consciously in many cases to reduce carbon emissions, but that's the effect that it's had. So I don't see why anyone would say that coal and oil are intrinsically better than natural gas. Similarly, I don't see why fossil fuels are better than renewable sources of energy. There are some technical problems. I mean, renewable sources are more intermittent and you need to be able to store them, and there's other distribution issues. But that's just an important example, but it's not obvious that that reducing carbon emissions has to lead to some sort of backward move for civilization. And I think we should be using all our technological and economic resources to figure out ways to do it without causing that kind of, you know, without causing economic harm.
We're down to our last 90 seconds, and you aim to wrap the book up with a view of what we do going forward. And to me, one of the great warnings in the book is looking at sea level, the fact that sea level's rising. If it's a few millimeters a year, it could be a foot in 100 years. But I know the concern is that that could change in a more rapid fashion, and that we've got to really be looking at our coastlines and be thinking very clearly, because even though Sandy isn't likely to happen again this year or next year or maybe the next 10, we're more vulnerable now, aren't we?
Yes, we are more vulnerable, and it could be several feet by 2100. And so I think we just have to become a little more forward-thinking in how we understand environmental risks and be better prepared and make the best use of science that we can in doing that.
Are you an optimist that our policymakers and frankly our civilization is accepting that and dealing with it rapidly enough?
I think we haven't been dealing with rapidly enough up to now, but I'm optimistic that that's changing. And, for example, the recent U.S.-China climate agreement and the current negotiations going on are giving many of us greater hope than we had before, that the nations of the world may be able to come to a better agreement on this than we have in the past.
Adam, thank you for taking the time, and I want to remind our listeners the book is called Storm Surge, Hurricane Sandy, Our Changing Climate and Extreme Weather of the Past and Future. Adam is an atmospheric scientist at Columbia University. You'll find his work occasionally in Salon and some other places, and I know you write a blog as well. Where's your blog online?
AdamSobel.org.
Pretty simple. He's also on Twitter. So you answered a lot of great questions from our listeners this hour. I know they appreciate it, and so do I. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
Adam Sobel, our guest for the hour. Thanks to our listeners for taking the time to join the conversation. Mike Black is our engineer. I'm Evan Dawson, and you can always get this program available in a podcast, wxxinews.org/connections. If you ever miss the program or want to share it, we always love when you do that as well. Education Friday tomorrow. Have a great Thursday afternoon. This is member-supported public radio.